this Tailwind tip brought to you by Sally McRae and I, actually. And Sally doesn't even know what it is. So I include Sally because she's there and I'm sure going to help round out this tip. I was listening to a podcast, and it may or may not have been a Trail Runner Nation podcast. I like podcasts. And I had heard this one before, and I thought, you know what? I heard this when I was running X Trail at this point. You know how you can place yourself to a certain comment, mm-hmm. or when somebody tells you something on a trail run, you go, I remember, Scott, you told me that story, and it was a year ago, and we were running right across that bridge when you told me that.
Yeah,
have you experienced that, Sally?
Yes. It was an impacting moment.
So I was asking myself, why is it that we have that ability? How come we can place comments to location and time? And so I always like to kind of dig into that stuff. That's what I like to do. I figured that's essential for our survival. Most things that we do well that come intuitively or naturally are there because it helps protect us and preserve us, mm-hmm. and allows us to, you know, pass on to the next generation. And so I could imagine there are certain places on the planet that might be dangerous. Like, this is where the lion attacks you. This is where there's water. This is where the enemy resides, or a safe place to sleep, right? Mm-hmm. These are the things that we need to know to protect ourselves. And so there are words of wisdom that are passed down that we can very accurately place time and location when we hear them, and they're bookmarked in our own consciousness. And I think that when we experience that, when we're running down the trail and we go, I remember you told me that story when I was, you know, at that, we're right over by that thing. Mm-hmm. And I always think it's so weird that we have that type of accuracy.
Mm-hmm. I didn't, wait, is there a question that you're going to ask me?
No, you know, see, so that was kind of like
I
drop off. And it's a discussion, right. Not necessarily. It's a tailwind discussion, like a tip of the trail kind of life experience on the trail.
Okay, now I'm following better.
Yeah. So much like taking your first swig of tailwind and, you know, remembering how great it tastes, how the electrolyte balance is right, and how it satisfies that thirst that you have. You can find that at tailwindnutrition.com and check out all their flavors. Their new caffeinated raspberry buzz.
You're not using this, John.
The naked type. Oh, I'm using it. That's all. You know, you came strong this morning, Sally. So go out to tailwindnutrition.com.
Are we recording?
Face, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
1-3-4-5-6. Check.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr.
Today we're going to do a fantastic, I think, a fantastic podcast, if you ask me.
It was in your mind anyway before we started.
Absolutely. It played out that way. about just a very, very unique run that I've heard about. There's a great deal of trail runner lore about this run, and it's called Hard Rock. It happens July 11th through the 13th of this year, 2014, in the San Juan Mountains. From the town of Silverton, Colorado, there's 140 runners. They're going to travel 100 miles with 67,984 feet of total elevation change. And Scott, if that doesn't make you just sit back and go, wait a second, that sounds like a lot of climbing to me. What do? They give you 48-hour cutoff time for this race, which is longer than most ultras that are out there of that distance. So we'd like to welcome race director Dale Garland so we can talk to him about what makes this race so special and so crazy.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks, Don. Glad to be
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
You know, as I was looking at this race, there's a couple things that tickled my funny bone. And one of them is the rule number one. You go to the rule section that the runners need to read. Rule number one, no whining.
right.
Okay,
that's
you gotta
right.
love a
no
race.
No whining.
You gotta love a race where rule number one is no whining, because you know every runner, if they're gonna read the rules, they're gonna at least read number one.
You go to the top. Do you start at the top or the bottom? I go to the top. Let's see what the number
one
rule is.
And it's the most important rule, because we can deal with everything else if we don't have to deal with whiny runners.
So that's tell right. us a little bit about this run. Well, actually, I want to add one other thing. The other thing that caught my eye was in the description of this run, you call it, or the board of directors or whoever calls it, this is a postgraduate 100-mile race. This is right. not a race for novices. This is a race for right. people that have run multiple hundreds and are looking for more challenge, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And before we launch off from the starting line here, let's talk a little bit about Dale, because he's an ultra runner. He's not he's just not a race director. He's a multiple time finisher of Leadville, and that's a 100-mile race, as we know. He's been out to Western States in our neck of the woods and finished very well out there. So he knows how to run, and he knows the needs of an ultra runner. And there's nothing better than to have a race director that understands. So it's good that you're in that position.
Yeah, thanks. You know, and that really did help, I think, you know, when setting it up, that this was a run designed by runners for runners, you know. And all of us who put it together, we all shared that common, not only love of the sport, but also the knowledge of what it is. So that original group, many of which are still part of the organization 22 years later, are, you know, we try to keep the runners first and foremost in how we do things.
Tell us a little bit about the history. Why 22 years ago, why did you decide to take 100-mile races up a notch?
Right. Well, kind of the story is that this was Hard Rock was the brainchild of a man in Boulder by the name of Gordon Hardman, who really
no
had
wait. His name is Hardman.
Gordon Hardman, you bet. I kid
His
you
last
not.
Name is
I
Hardman.
I kid you not.
And kind of goes along with Gordy, too, kind of the
of
founder
course.
Of Ultra. So, I mean, this almost sounds like a fictional story. So,
yeah, you can't make this stuff up, right?
No, yeah.
And so what Gordon wanted to do, there were a couple things. One, he loved the San Juan Mountains. For those of uninitiated, Boulder sits on the Front Range of Colorado, and the San Juans are about, by car, 6 to 7 hours away. We're down in the southwest corner of Colorado. And we're some of the more, I live in Durango. I live in the San Juan. So it's my backyard, but I think it's one of the most breathtaking places in the United States when it comes to mountains. But, so Gordon got this idea that he would like to do something that celebrated the legacy and the lives of a group of people who carved their lives out of hard rock mining. And he did that with this idea of connecting the four historical mining towns of Silverton, Ouray, Telluride, and Lake City. And then it was just a matter of kind of putting it together, recruiting people with different skill sets to kind of put together a course and an organization around that central principle.
Was Mr. Hardman an ultra runner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. He was. And actually, the way I got involved with it was, you mentioned I was at Western States. His wife and my father were at an aid station and got to talking, and his wife said, well, my husband's thinking of putting this run together, and my dad, being my dad, volunteered me to help. He goes, oh, yeah, Dale would love to help with that. So that's how I kind of got involved in it.
You know, there's all kinds of mischief that happens at aid stations, and tight friendships and bonds that happen.
So I got to the end of Western States, and my dad said, "Oh, guess what? You should go call Gordon Hardman because he's interested in you helping him with this event." And so that's how the whole thing started, and that's how I got involved.
Are you local out there in Colorado? So were you from Colorado out here running states? And so it was just a natural fit. It's in your backyard.
Correct. Correct. Exactly. Exactly. Good thing. And the course was actually, the hardest part was actually finding trails and, you know, places to go, how to connect the towns logistically. And so we had two people, one who'd grown up in Telluride. His name is John Kappas. And then the second one, and some of your listeners might recognize the name of Rick Trujillo, who's been running mountains longer than most of us have been alive. And they were the ones, that, and it was literally in their backyards, and they're the ones who kind of took out the maps and started putting, you know, basically the trails together. Oh, we could go here, we go up over this mountain, and da-da-da-da-da. That's how it ended up.
Tell us about those first couple years, 22 years ago, 21 years ago. How did you get people to decide they wanted to run this thing? How many people ran it, and what were those early years like?
The first couple of years, there's a definite turning point. The first year we had 18 finishers. We had 36 people, or 42 people, excuse me. And it was just, you know, and this was in the days before, I may be dating myself now, but the days, you know, before the internet and all the social media and stuff like that. So it was mostly just people who wanted to come out and take a risk on this new hundred. And there weren't a lot of hundreds around. I mean, you know, there was the big ones, the Grand Slam, and then a few others. But we got 40 people to try. We didn't really know what we were doing. And of course, for a first year event, of course, the weather was bad. And so we were in the snow and rain and that kind of thing. The marmots were eating the trail flags because we didn't know what, you know, how to mark the course. So people were going off the course and all those things that, you know, you learn by experience. And we did that for a couple of years. And then I remember one of our runners wrote in Ultra Running that somebody was going to get hurt and or die on the Hard Rock course. And after that, we had this never-ending group of people who wanted to run it.
Oh, my. You know, that kind of relates to the question I was going to ask you.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say, we'll get back to that, but this is kind of related. You know, you had 42 runners to the first year, 18 that finished. How did it go the second year? Did you get a greater number of runners?
No, it actually went down. It actually went down. went down. We dropped, you know, not very much. We dropped down to 35 runners. And then after the article was written, we shot up into the mid-70s, and it just grew from there.
I think that's what attracts Don to this, is the mystique of physical harm and or death.
There you go. Well, yeah.
I went on and watched some video, you know, as I was doing the research last night. And number one, the course is just set in a place that looks unbelievable. The mountain ranges, the climbs, and some of the downhills. I saw the screed that is on the trail. These guys are going down with trekking poles and nearly skiing down these things. And you know they're climbing something similar on the other side of it.
Right.
It's just incredible.
Right. And I think thank John Kappas and Rick Trujillo, because they they were mountain goats, and they just said, "We'll just go up this scree slope or down this scree slope, you know, because that's where they played, you know, and that's where they ran."
I was going to say that you can be an amateur photographer and go out on this course,
yeah,
and become a professional photographer just by snapping the shutter, because the views that I've seen are just spectacular.
So you've gone from 42 and 35 starters to last year, or was it this year, 1,279 people applied into the lottery. And
right. Sorry.
There's a couple of runners now.
Yeah. These are the ones that are dropping out.
You know, one of the...
No whining.
Yeah. One of the...
Yeah. I set my dogs after him. See, that's what happens if you start to whine.
One of the common threads of ultra runners we found out as we've been interviewing over the years is they all have dogs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know what? They do.
And so we welcome the dogs.
Yeah. Good observation. Yeah. So 140 are accepted into the race. Why not more? What's capped this 140?
Mm-hmm. That number is set by our special events permit. That's issued by the Bureau of Land Management. And so it's basically a number that they feel that with all things considered, within the context of the course and the mountains and the terrain and that kind of thing, is what they call the resource can handle. And so periodically, in fact, we're going through the process now of evaluating that to see if that's the true number, or if there's more or less or that kind of thing, through a process called an environmental assessment.
You know, in speaking to some other race directors, their comment, at least, and you can comment on this as well. It's not so much the number of runners as the support teams and crews and people that are in and around trying to get in and out of aid stations. It's the biggest impact.
Exactly. Yeah, and that became very aware when we went through this environmental assessment process, was the things that impact things more are the crews how do you deal with the parking and those kinds of things. And I don't think Hard Rock is unique in that aspect. I think we as a sport are all having to deal with that and come up with things and strategies and policies and things to deal with those, because the sport's growing, which is a good thing.
So with a large number of applicants and a very mm-hmm. small number of successful runners, racers every year, tell us a little bit about your lottery. I know it's a little more unique than some out there. Talk to us about that.
Right. Well, I'm going to go back to one of your first comments that when we set this up as an event, we felt, and primarily for safety reasons more than anything else, that somebody who wanted to try this should have experience of running 100 miles. There aren't a lot of things that you can do to replicate some of the altitude changes and some of the up and down that Hard Rocker runners go through, but we wanted them to have the experience of being out on their feet for 100 miles. So that being said, it's an ongoing process. It's an ever-changing process. We have a set of qualifying runs that we use all at 100 miles or thereabout in terms of kilometers, where successful completion of that within a certain number of years will allow you to get into the lottery. And then what we do is we actually have three lotteries. We have a lottery for veterans, which are people who have finished Hard Rock more than five times. And then we have a lottery for people who have applied but haven't got in. And then we have a lottery for people who have never applied. And then we have certain spots. We have certain numbers of spots allocated for each one of those lotteries. So if you, Don, get this unrelenting urge to come and run Hard Rock, you would be in the lottery with everybody else who has never applied to run Hard Rock.
Got it. And to be a veteran, five-time finisher, that qualifies you as a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Tough luck to those guys four times. It's like you haven't earned veteran status, pal. You gotta go five, and that's five completions, I would imagine. Correct.
That's five completions. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you lose points for DNFing? Do you like lose one of your years?
No. We don't subtract things. We just continue to add.
Okay. So, I don't know. You guys get your own policies there in Colorado, so I just want to ask.
So each of those lotteries, how many? What percentage of tickets do you pull out of each of those lotteries? So let's say there's 100 veterans. How many tickets do you pull versus the 900 first timers?
Yeah,
exactly. And I should say this, that this is rocket science, because half of the people who devise this lottery work at Los Alamos National Labs in New Mexico. So they have access and they run these things just as if this was some kind of national defense.
Well, it's more important than that. This is Hard Rock. I mean, national defense. We have a little wiggle room there. You know, we've got large bodies of water between us and others. But this is Hard Rock.
That's right. This is it. So what we do is, I want to make two comments. First is we have, it's a 35-70-35 split. So 35 veterans with five or more finishes, 70 for people who have applied at least once, but have, or up to and including finished four times, and then 35 spots for people who have never applied. So,
no, that, so
35, 70, 35.
So do you have a better shot your first time applying, or do your odds increase as once you get into that second bucket where you're in that 70%?
The 70 slots, you mean?
Yeah, 70 slots. Sorry.
I think, you know, it all depends on who applies. You know, okay. it's a yearly thing. And I know, you know, it's kind of, literally what we do is we produce tickets. And so, Don, you would have, you know, again, using you as your example, you would have one ticket and your name would be in a ticket, and we throw all the names into a jar and we just start drawing out names until we get to 140. So it's high tech, but at the end, it's all about getting your name drawn out of a jar.
It goes from high tech to I've seen the pin board that you use. Yeah. It's posted online. Those Los Alamos guys, they haven't got the spreadsheet going. They're still using some
cork. And we've been asked, you know, people said, well, why don't you just do it? Why don't you just do it on, you know, on a just do random generators and put in a program? I mean, you know, there's technology to do that, but there's just something very tactile and very exciting about drawing names out. You know, and
agreed.
And then we
upload
it to Twitter and that kind of stuff. So there's a little bit of nostalgia in that part.
You know, I agree with that. And in fact, Western States went to a random generator for a few years or maybe a couple of years, and they've gone back. Now they have the big cage that they turn around.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The days with the Gatorade bucket, right? They're reaching in there. I knew there was some tape to the side. I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
There's always suspect when you're getting
down
to the end.
Well, we do it in a hyperbolic. We do it in a chamber, you know, with suits on. No, I'm just kidding. You know,
I like that. Weather conditions. What kind of things? We know there's a lot of elevation on that, but radical weather changes. What do you expect on that day?
You runners who run hard rock can expect everything from, let's say 75 degrees to snow. And it's happened, you know, a lot of years where people just, you can be at relatively low altitude. The lowest point on our course is in the town of Ouray, which is around 9,000. And then you can be up on top of Handy's Peak and be caught in a snowstorm or a thunderstorm or something, a lightning storm. I mean, those are things that are, I mean, not only weather related, but really as a director are just really, really, they make me really nervous when I know I've got runners out there in snowstorms and lightning storms and things like that.
Do you have,
run the full gamut.
Do you have equipment requirements that you must carry? You know, some races, you know, I think over in Europe have some of those.
Right. You have to carry certain things. We haven't gone to that yet, but most runners, we suggest that they be ready to sit out, in the environment, sit out a thunderstorm or, some kind of a temporary weather front that moves through.
You spoke about trail markings earlier, and there's some things that filter down from on the trail that you hear about different races. And one of the things that scares me about Hard Rock, besides the name itself, is are the trail markings, because there's not as I was looking through the pictures, it kind of confirmed what I heard. There's not a lot of trees to hang things on in a lot of these cases, and so there are literally markers that are in the ground. And from what I've heard, here's what I've heard, that the animals come by and actually eat it and step on it and can disrupt the orienteering portion of the race.
Right. You're exactly right. And that happens. So I remember the first year we did it with just little pieces of plastic, and we found that marmots and other high altitude creatures love to eat on plastic and that kind of thing. So then we went to, it made course clearing really easy. You know, didn't have much to clean up afterwards. But now we have on long metal stakes, reflective tape with our, you know, with a logo on it and that kind of thing. But a runner may go a half mile or so between, or three quarters of a mile, on roads even a little bit further between markers. So
I've experienced that reflective tape a couple years back, and maybe they still have it, but at San Diego 100 down there, that they were using the reflective tape, and your headlamp will just bounce off of that, and it is like a beacon.
Right. So now the only thing we have to worry about with trail markers is we have to get the local elk population and the local deer population and sheep to kind of abide by the fact that these markers need to stay upright in the ground at least for a couple days.
And speaking of trail, one of the things that we enjoy on most trails is it's a well-defined single track. I was zooming in on part of your trail to see if I could see that well-defined single track, and I think you're kind of just making your own track out there in some cases. At least that looked like it to me.
Some places, yeah. Some places there are. Yeah, there's three or four places where route finding and orienteering skills come in very handy.
Gosh,
but the other thing is, over 20 years, the course has remained relatively the same with a few minor changes and that kind of thing. So we've tried to, with the BLM's help and the Forest Service help, we do a lot of stuff on their systems trails, but they've been very generous in allowing us to use trails that we lay in, these social trails that have been part of our course, and they haven't forced us to move off of those onto systems trails, which we're real grateful for.
I don't know the answer to this, so I'm going to ask a question. Has okay. Hard Rock ever been canceled because of snow or other weather conditions?
Yeah, it happened twice. One year it was canceled in 1995 because of too much snow, and then it was canceled. I have to go back to my notes. It was canceled in 2002 because of not enough snow and because of fire dangers.
Okay.
And so, we just felt his best interest on both cases. The safety of the crews, runners, and volunteers was paramount, and it was too extreme of conditions to hold an event.
And when that happens, Dale, do you what did you do with the runners? Do you move them up to the next year automatically, or do you just say, hey,
yeah, we gave them priority in the next year if they wanted to run.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So what's the typical finisher rate? We know the rate for the first run of you started with 42, ended with 18.
Mm-hmm.
What does a finisher rate look like these days?
Overall?
Yeah.
The overall percentage is 61%, which isn't too bad for an event of our difficulty. I think it can be attributed to the fact that people who come here and run they do know what they're doing, and so I think that's a big part of it.
And you don't set yourself up going to Hard Rock with thinking it's just walk through the park. It is not. You're going to be confronted with possibly the most difficult challenge of your entire life, and so you come ready.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think so, and I think that speaks volumes about the preparation for people. We have people who come here. We call it Camp Hard Rock, and it's actually developed into quite of a social thing too, where people come out here for a couple weeks early. And spend time up on the course and, hiking and enjoying the beauty of the area and that kind of stuff, getting acclimated and that kind of thing. So it's become almost, it's a running race, but there's a whole kind of camp that comes around it now.
What have you seen in the runners, how they've changed over the 22 years, whether in gear or philosophies or how they strategically attack the race?
Yes. A few changes in all those. How's that?
Yeah, that's good. Well, do you want to tackle any one of those individually?
Yeah, okay. I think the first thing is the technology part is phenomenal in terms of things, hydration systems and knowledge about feed and fluids and, shoes have come such a long ways and that kind of thing. And it's cool to see that. The philosophy of the attitude of runners, I would say, hasn't changed that much,
That's
at least
good.
In our event. And I think it's part because they come here and they become part of a shared experience with others who have been here for a while, and they just kind of blend themselves into the culture and into the philosophy of hard rock, and they don't whine. That's the nice thing. I've never had to invoke my number one rule. I've never had to, you know.
You haven't pulled a bib because someone was whining too much?
Right. Exactly.
You know, Dale, we have a good friend of ours and podcast guest that's been with us, Bob Crowley. He has mm-hmm. run Hard Rock the last mm-hmm. 2 years.
Right.
And mm-hmm. we asked him to help us out today and ask some sure. questions about what questions he would like to know about Hard Rock, or what he thinks uh-huh. the nation of ultra runners that listen to this podcast would like to know.
You bet.
He asked for us to ask you to describe the Hard Rock culture and how it's evolved and what makes the Hard Rock culture different from maybe other ultras.
Yeah. Boy, that's a really good question.
Would you say it's different?
Yeah, it's different. It is different. I direct Hard Rock. That's the only event I've had both my hips replaced, so I don't compete anymore. Mm-hmm. So I don't travel around much. And so, but I think the Hard Rock culture is about celebrating the effort and celebrating the accomplishment of everybody. We have some real unique traditions. You know, when people finish, they actually stay around and cheer other people as they come in. We have a huge, we often have more people cheering the last person coming in than we do having the first person coming in. And so there's a real shared sense of commonality, I think, and shared experiences that I don't know if other other runs may have it. I just know that that's something that we foster and we celebrate and that kind of thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
If I may submit, just as it's part of conversation, mm-hmm. perhaps the culture is so strong and tight-knit is because it's so dangerous out there. You've got, you know, 67,000 plus feet, 100 mm-hmm. miles mm-hmm. through extreme weather conditions, and orienteering may be part of it. And as a community of ultra runners, we do care for one another. That's one of the mm-hmm. one of the things that attracts mm-hmm. us each to the sport. Mm-hmm. And when you have a venue like yours, then it's important to be tight, and you feel a brotherhood right. and a sisterhood, and so I think culture exactly. comes with that danger.
Right, right. Yeah. I agree. You know, and there's been multiple cases where, and his name escapes me right now, but he actually gave up, he abandoned his attempt to finish Hard Rock because he felt it was more important to go back and rescue somebody else who was mm-hmm. having some real distressful kinds of things. Right at the end, I swore to myself I would never forget his name, but I have. But, you know, just that kind of thing where people look out for each other. I think another part of it is Silverton is a town of 600 people. And so when we descend on Silverton, we all know each other, you know, and we run into each other. Silverton's a town with one paved street, and you get to know everybody. And you run into them. There's two coffee shops and there's four restaurants. And so you just get to know people really well. And I think that's part of it as well.
How does the town of Silverton, do they embrace the ultra runner? Do they
love it?
Yeah, good.
They love it. Yeah, they love it. Both from an economic perspective, obviously, but also just the vibe that we bring to Silverton. Silverton is kind of the epitome of that hard rockers, we can do anything, we're rough and tough, we're wild and tough kind of mentality. I mean, that's just, they're all an old hard rock mining town. And so they've really embraced us with open arms, both, you know, financially and philosophically.
Yeah. What is the industry in Silverton now? Coffee shop owner?
Tourism.
Okay. Ultra runners.
Ultra runners, yeah. Tourism really is the thing, you know, is basically what they have now because most of the mines have shut down.
Okay.
It's also home to, I'll put in a plug just for Silverton Mountain Ski Area. It's the highest ski area in the United States. And so people come here for the extreme skiing in the winter. But tourism is the driving force in Silverton.
Do you think that there are any other 100 mile or greater, or maybe even a little bit less races that can even compare to Hard Rock? Have you heard or do you know of any that
in difficulty, Scott?
Well, difficulty and in possibly the culture.
Okay.
Yeah. I think in difficulty, you know, like I think about, I've thought about this for a long time. You know, there's no way I'd ever want to do Badwater. You know, I think that would be, I'd rather run two Hard Rocks, you know, than run through 135 degrees, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, you know,
on pavement.
Yeah, on pavement. Yeah. So, I mean, that's tough, you know, and I know this may sound kind of, you know, condescending or whatever, but running 100 miles is running 100 miles, and it's tough. And maybe it's not condescending. It's just tough, you know. I know when I ran Western States, running through those canyons in the heat and that kind of stuff, that was hard on me. That was much harder than running through the mountains for me. So I don't know. In terms of culture, again, I hear from other people who travel around that there's not a lot of other runs that have that same kind of shared experience that we've developed and we've fostered, but there may be others. I'm not sure. I like it. It's part of what I find real enjoyable about being the director of this is almost like reunions, almost seeing people every year and reconnecting with them and finding out what's gone on in their lives and, you know, sharing joys and sharing tragedies with, you know, or bad things with people.
And watching their families, because families and crew become part of the same team.
Excellent point. Yeah, I mean, I've watched at least four families of kids grow up at Hard Rock, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and watch them go from being little kids through their formative years to, I mean, one family I remember, I have a mobile DJ business kind of on the side. I DJed two of their weddings.
Wow.
So, you know, so it goes from having little kids to, you know, watching them walk down the aisle, which is kind of cool.
That's one thing that Bob Crowley has talked to us about is that type of feeling when he goes to Hard Rock. It's a very low-key, family-oriented type of a race where everybody feels like they can talk to each other and just a small knit group. I wanted to ask you one question. I don't know if this is a fact or not. And it kind of goes back to that being low key. The start of the race, I've seen a couple videos of the start of the race. You know, it's not this big glorified, you know, gigantic blow up arch with a shotgun or a horn going off. You're just standing there and you said, okay, guys, and you take your hand and go, well, let's go. Is that true? That's all you do,
That's
huh?
That's true. Yeah, get out of here is what I usually say. You know?
Okay, get out of here.
Get out of here. You know,
I saw a picture of somebody singing the national anthem. Is that standard protocol?
No, last year, it was the first year we did. We just had somebody, the daughter of one of our runners, came up and said, you know, I'd love to sing the national anthem. And I said, sure. You know, I thought it was cool.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. And then, at the back end of this is, I'm sure you've heard about kissing the Hard Rock and the finish of Hard Rock and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
How did that get started? I've seen it. It's in the rule book, rule number 12 or something like that.
You got to kiss the Hard Rock.
You got to kiss the Hard Rock. Where did that come from? Mm-hmm. How did that get started?
Going back to the first couple of years, we were all standing there at the warming hut at the local ski area, and I hadn't really thought it all the way through, like a finish line. And so somebody said, well, how do we know when we finish? And I looked around, there was just this rock. It was just this little rock, you know, just sitting there. And I said, okay, well, you just got to touch the rock. That'll be good enough.
So that's when the timer stops, is when they kiss the rock?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
that's fantastic.
In fact, And it's kind of evolved from there. It's gone from this little rock in the ground to this big 3-ton boulder that we have painted now with our logo, and it sits at the end of a finished chute. It's much more, it is much more developed than it was in the beginning, but it's a mecca to some people. I try to greet every runner. I try to be there for every finish, and to see the emotion and the joy and all the emotional release of people when they come in, it's pretty phenomenal. It's pretty cool. And people, they walk around there almost in reverence, you know?
Yeah. But you know, Scott mentioned rule number 12. Is it rule 12? I've got to imagine that rule 13 is, if you haven't completed the race, you don't kiss the rock. I would think that would be almost sacrilegious. You don't.
Yeah. I mean, it gets to that point almost. It's like, no, I can't be near that until I only want to be there when I finish, you know.
Can you take a picture by it?
Yeah, you can take pictures of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you stand by it and take a picture? You just can't kiss
it.
Oh,
sure. Okay. Yeah. In fact, it sits in Silverton. There's this little pocket park right off where the race finishes in front of the Silverton School Gym. And there's just this little park, and it sits there, and people go and have their picture taken next to it, you know, stand next to it all the time and have their picture taken. But once it becomes race weekend, it takes on a whole bigger context.
Gosh, I'm having a burning desire to kiss something like I've never wanted to kiss before.
I'm glad I'm out of reach.
Well, that joke, there was the second year when we just did this, our second place finisher, who was one of the pioneers of ultra running, his name was Dennis Herr. He came into the finish. I said, "You got to kiss that." And he goes, "I'm not kissing it." I go, "Well, clock's still running." And so the clock's been running on him for 20 years.
Oh, really? That's the longest finish time.
It just keeps going because I told him, I said, "I'm not going to stop the clock until you kiss that rock."
And that is hilarious.
You need to put a widget or whatever it's called on the website with that still running and his name underneath it. Kiss the rock.
Kiss the rock, Dennis Herr. The time is still going.
It is still running.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, if there's some people out there that know how to build that widget, would you do it and send it over to Dale?
Yeah, please, and let me know, and I'll give you the time that he came close to the rock, and we can extrapolate to that. Well, wait a minute. I work with.
Yeah, you have rocket scientists. Yeah. They should be able to figure that out.
Yeah. Rocket scientists.
Yeah.
Hey, so we talk about the difficulty of the course, right? I mean, and it's fun to, from a comfortable chair, to say, man, all that climbing, right. It gets cold, it can get hot, who knows what can happen, it can switch on you in a second. But there's also inherent health risk when it comes to that. Have you integrated any special protocols or cutting edge on how to help and manage ultra runners in extreme environments?
I don't know if we're high tech. I don't know if we're cutting edge. We are very cognizant, and we have, I think, we have a medical crew that, I mean, that's where their interests are. The search and rescue people of the high altitude of Silverton, Telluride, Ouray, and Lake City, our emergency and medical emergency services coordinator, his name is Leo Lloyd, and he is, there's very few people that I trust more than Leo Lloyd in the outdoor environment. And we just are very cognizant of what can happen. And we have people, we train everybody at the volunteer briefing. We have roving medics. We have helicopters on alert so we can evacuate close, you know, quickly, those kind of things. So I'm not sure it's cutting edge by any sense of the imagination, but it's something that is foremost in our minds all the time, that something could happen at the drop of a hat to any one of these people.
With 48 hours as the potential length of a race, or at least for cutoff, do people get some sleep time in between? Is that something that's common or uncommon?
Some do.
Or sometimes it's forced. I get that.
yeah. It's I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon to, as you look at people's in and out times of aid stations, to see hour and a half, 2 hours, where they just have to sit and collect their thoughts. There's the halfway point for Hard Rock is in a town called Ouray, and it's in a park where there's a nice warm hot springs, and it's right next to restaurants, and that's where we see a lot of people drop out, because either way, when we run the clockwise or counterclockwise, either way, they've got to go climbing up, you know, for hours and hours to get to the next checkpoint. Or they can go to the restaurant and go into the hot tub. So, but
that's inviting.
I'm just looking at the elevation profile here, Dale, from Ouray at mile, like, what, 56?
Right.
To the next peak, which is over 13,000 feet, is only 10 miles.
Right.
10
right.
miles with, that's got to be, what, 5,000 feet of climbing?
5,000, yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
This year, you have any... Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead, sorry.
No, finish your thought. I was changing to a...
in a lot of time that's done at night. On a very, it's a well-developed trail. It's a well-defined trail, but it's a very dangerous trail. And so, yeah, it's a hike out of Ouray, you know.
We focused a lot of this podcast on the run itself, because that really is the star is Hard Rock course profile, etc. But there are some stars running this race this year. This is a very competitive year and
exactly.
very exciting. Do you think this might be the most competitive of years, or what is your thought?
Oh yeah, by far and away. It's the quality of that front group is the best I've seen in my 22 years of being involved in Hard Rock. You know, when you have names like Jornet and Campbell and Chenault and Chourier and Jones and Timmy Olson, you know, and Scott Hyme, I mean, it's going to be exciting. Yeah. The ultra world will love this one.
Absolutely. But when I look at the waiting list of front runners as well, you could have another competitive field that's just as amazing to boast about. The waiting list is incredible.
It's an embarrassment of riches this year. You know, it really was.
Do you ever consider saying, you know what, we're just gonna build a race of amazing front, the Kentucky Derby, if you will. We're gonna bring in just these top names and just have everybody enjoy watching these most competitive of front runners compete.
Right. It gets talked about, and it gets talked about not only on a variety of levels, you know, and it's both inside the Hard Rock community and external to the Hard Rock community. I've heard that, that kind of conversation, and hey, why don't you do that? And that kind of thing. So it's something that it's fun to think about, and it's fun to kind of imagine. So we'll see.
You know, as a guy that's not up in front, I just think that what's special about the race is everybody has the same shot to get in, and you're running with the competing against the elite. Not that you're going to beat them by kissing the rock, but it's the race that's important, and the runner, the individual runner and accomplishment, that's the most important thing. And that's what's cool about ultra running, is it's about the accomplishment.
And that is and again, to kind of go back to this idea, you know, we try to bring that forward even with, you know, those front runners, in terms of they're the ones that lead, kind of, they come back and cheer the mid pack and the back of the pack runners. And they're the ones who are kind of trying, you know, cause they're trying to become part of the culture, and they've done a really good job. I don't know if you've read much of like Dakota Jones blogging and that kind of stuff, but you know, here's a guy who, you know, just loves everything about being in Silverton and being part of this event. And I like it. I think it's cool. People who could just say, just another notch on my belt, say, no, this is something worth investing time and energy in, becoming part of something bigger than just the event.
I think it's special.
Yeah.
So, I don't know the statistics on this, and that's why I'm going to ask this question. Kyle Skaggs, holds mm-hmm. the record for the fastest time, which is just under 24 correct. Hours, 23:23. Mm-hmm. Back in 2008, not to discount, Deanna Finkel holds the women's record from 2009 mm-hmm. at 27:18. The average mm-hmm. finish time is just over 41 hours. So that puts you in perspective, 48 hours mm-hmm. is the cutoff. The average finish time is 41. Right. Some races offer different types of belt buckle colors depending on mm-hmm. if you finish within a certain time. Mm-hmm. What does a finisher at Silverton at Hard Rock get besides a rock as a boyfriend?
or a girlfriend.
Sorry.
My rock is female, pal. Gosh. It's true colors come out.
We do have belt buckles. We do have belt buckles for sale. They get a shirt. Yeah, they get a shirt. And we did something at the beginning of this. We said, what makes Hard Rock kind of unique? What can we do to celebrate and make it something kind of special? And so every year we have and you mentioned a little bit about the photography and stuff like that. We mm-hmm. commit. We have a contest of, and it can be any kind of medium or visual medium, painting. We have paintings, we've had photography, that kind of stuff, that we create every year a different finisher poster that we put their name and time, and we present that at the award ceremony, and they get that and a T-shirt.
And I think our own Katie DeSplinter was the photographer last
mm-hmm.
year, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this year. Hers is this year.
Oh, it was this year. Oh, okay, so mm-hmm. they get a picture. Yeah, they get a print of Katie DeSplinter's photo she took.
Right, right. That's the official photo for 2014.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful photo, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's stunning, you know. So, but yeah. So that's what they get.
Dale, where do you see Hard Rock in the next 22 years?
Good question. Are
you still going to be around in 22 years as a race director?
I'm glad you qualified that. Of course, he's going to be around.
Oh no, I know he's going to be around.
That was a tough question there.
It was a tough question. Yeah. I think in the next 3 to 5 years, I wouldn't say a watershed, but we're going to, you know, as we kind of continue to figure out how we can accommodate this ever-increasing number of people who are interested, yet maintaining kind of the sense of who we are, that will be the next 3 to 5 years' work for me. I don't know if I'll be around for 22, but I'll be around for the next 3 to 5.
So, it's easy to have passion for something that is so amazing and so fun to be around, so much energy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I've always kind of tried to, yeah, I'm the race director, but I think one of the things that is I've tried to do my 22 years of being involved in this is create a sense of ownership on all levels. So if something happened to, you know, if I wasn't around, Hard Rock would go on in the same kind of sense of camaraderie and the same cultural statements and the same culture and that kind of stuff. I would hope would outlive me.
Don and I have talked a lot about that whole subject there. So we really associate with that.
Yeah, there's a place for Trail Runner Nation when we're ready to hang up the mic that it needs to continue on with people that are passionate about the sport.
Exactly. You hope that you've laid the groundwork for something that will live on. You know, live on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So. So I don't know. It'll be real interesting I guess I know where we won't be. I mean, we won't be a run of 400 people, you know, we won't that kind of thing. But other than that, there's a lot of things that we could possibly be.
Yeah. Well, Don has already filled out the application
as we were sitting here talking.
And fortunately, Don and I are going to hand deliver that application here.
Very
next
nice.
Month.
Yeah.
We're coming out there
I love it.
To be part of the race, not running the race this year. Petzl, who's one of your sponsors, has invited us to come with them and do some coverage of the race, do some interviews with some of their athletes that will be racing. And we're also associated with Tailwind Nutrition, which is just a neighbor of yours in Durango.
The Veerlings. We're real excited about both of them being part of Hard Rock this year.
They've been longtime supporters of Trail Runner Nation, so we're excited that they're also associated with you guys.
And we're real excited that I'm excited just the fact that it's another Durango group. So yeah, I like it.
So we'll see you there at the start where you say get out of here. We're not going to get out of here when you say get out of here. We're going to hang around and maybe go back and catch some Z's, but we'll be on the course getting a little firsthand knowledge and sharing that with the nation as we experience the Hard Rock 100 wild and tough 100
wild
mile race.
Tough.
Run.
There you go.
Run. Sorry.
Yeah. Run. Run.
Thank you so much, Dale. We look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks and giving you a handshake and seeing part of your course.
Thank you for your time
today.
It's
been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. And to you, thanks for all that you do for our sport. And really enjoyed spending some time with both of you.
Now, Trail Runner Nation, Scott, I think there's a little bit of Hard Rock in all of us.
Is there?
Yeah.
I think so.
Some maybe more than others, but there's that spirit of the rock that's out there that drives people to the trailhead, that launches them into deep and dark places.
I think the tagline that they have on their logo, wild and tough, I can visualize those miners. I mean, they were tough freaking people.
I was going to ask that question during the podcast, Scott, which was, do you think the runners were tougher or the miners? Back in the day, of those two individuals?
I think that the runners are definitely better athletes, but I think toughness to withstand some of the weather patterns
day in and day out
in Silverton, Colorado, back in the 40s.
And the heavy work.
Yeah.
Right? It was not easy.
Yeah, they were in shape in a different way.
Well, they're both testaments to the human nature, right?
They're both pretty tough.
Yeah. Tougher than you and I are sitting here in an air-conditioned room in a soft chair talking on a mic.
So Trail Runner Nation members, watch the social media, and you'll see we're going to be posting videos and photos and tweets and Twitters.
We're going to stretch ourselves a little bit.
We're going to be
trying.
Dominating the social media, or at least our social media.
Yeah, no, it'll beat us on ours.
And we should come out with some pretty good interviews. We'll see how it pans out. We're really thankful for Petzl and the support that they've given us, and looking forward to spending some time with their athletes.
It's going to be fun to see all the media coverage that's out there. Certainly, I Run Far is going to be there. I mean, that's
their backyard.
Yep, and great coverage by I Run Far. So I'm sure that there'll be other media outlets and places and people that we'll be able to follow and track the progress.
I'm sure the Silverton Press will be covering the event.
Well, we learned there's how many people that live in the town?
600. Yeah. They got to have a newspaper.
Yeah, sure they do. So go out and
run
Mass.